Today's Talk 10 Tuesday is sponsored by Ipsapalooza. Get ready to conquer the 2024 ICD-10 code changes with expert guidance. Click on the link in the comments section to learn more. We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for August 29th, 2023. Today, we welcome Angela Comfort with important things for coders to watch out for at the intersection of coding and artificial intelligence. This morning, Gloriann Bryant has the latest coding news. Tiffany Ferguson reports on the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her TalkBack segment. Now, here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a man who's been contemplating quiet quitting, but he doesn't smoke, so what's the point? Chuck Buck.
Hey, thanks, Clark. Yeah, I think I'll have a pack right now to talk about it. Thanks, Clark Anthony. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 567th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, everyone. How are you?
Good. I'm doing well, thanks. As you heard Clark Anthony announced, Angela Comfort is with us again today. Angie was a semi-regular panelist, you might recall, on Talk 10 Tuesday during the run-up to ICD-10, and that's when she was with AHIMA. But she's returned, and this is her second appearance this year, and so we're very happy to have her. She's talking about a very timely topic this morning, AI and coding. Reaction?
Yeah. AI is all the rage now, isn't it?
It certainly is. So, Erica, what is your topic for your TalkBack this morning?
I'm going to talk about the AHIMA updated clinical validation practice brief.
Ooh, wow. Excellent topic, Erica. We look forward to hearing your talk back, as we usually do. We have much news to report. Folks, we begin with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Thanks, Chuck. And today we're going to talk about some announcements from CMS. In recent weeks, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has been very, very active in releasing a slew of updates that aim to extend healthcare coverage, improve maternal health, and combat fraudulent activities. So here's a quick rundown of some of the most noteworthy updates and their broader implications. First is the Medicaid renewal push. On August 11th, CMS launched a call to action for all federal and state agencies working with children and families. The objective is to make sure that as many people as possible renew their Medicaid coverage. This is an all-hands-on-deck approach that allows health plans, providers, and community organizations to utilize shared resources to keep children and families insured, especially in states that return to standard Medicaid renewal procedures. Next is the maternal health milestones. So in the same day, CMS approved Vermont's extension of postpartum Medicaid coverage for up to a year, made possible by the American Rescue Plan. This marks a significant milestone for maternal health, and now 36 states, including the District of Columbia and the U.S. Virgin Islands, have expanded postpartum Medicaid, aiming to combat the maternal health crisis in the U.S. Also, there's been growth in ACA enrollment. So CMS's early 2023 snapshot shows that 15.7 million people have effectuated their affordable care marketplace enrollments for February of 2023, a 13% increase over the previous year. The surge is partly due to the American Rescue Plan and the Inflation Reduction Act, which have both made health insurance more affordable for millions. Also, changes to the making care primary model. On August 14th, the release of the request for applications for the making care primary model set to launch on July 24th. This voluntary primary care model will be tested in 8 states and aims to improve care management, form partnerships with specialists, and address patients' social needs like housing and nutrition. Also, the spousal impoverishment provisions have been extended. So CMS extended the mandatory spousal impoverishment provisions for home and community-based services in Medicaid through September of 2027. This policy protects a portion of a married couple's resources, allowing married individuals to maintain their eligibility for necessary long-term care services. And also, New Jersey's premium security plan. New Jersey received an extension for its state innovation waiver for an additional 5 years. Actuarial analysis predicts that this extension will result in premiums being 15.8% lower on average for an individual health insurance starting for plan year 2024. And finally, combating hospice fraud. CMS is stepping up its efforts to identify and weed out fraudulent hospice care providers, and as of mid-August announced that site visits have been made to over 7,000 hospices to ensure compliance. Nearly 400 are under review for potential administrative actions. And through these various initiatives, CMS hopes to continue to make strides in ensuring that Americans have access to affordable, quality health care while keeping integrity and transparency at its core. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert. He's also the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. Now's the time for our quoting report, and substituting this morning for Lori Johnson is our good friend, Glorianne Bryant. And good morning, Glorianne.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chuck. That was a lot of information, Tim. So let me get into this quoting report for you this early morning here in California as we broadcast across the nation. Although the 2023 third quarter coding clinic was released, what I'd like to briefly talk about this morning is the continuing practice of insurance payers denying specific diagnoses that to the coding professional is a valid diagnosis reported. It was documented in the medical record, and we have guidance to support the reporting of that code. So what we're seeing and what we have to remember is that we have coding conventions. Of course, we want to follow those. We have coding guidelines and that we have AHA coding clinic, which is an official guidance as well. All of these must be followed. It's a lot to be followed. And starting with the coding classification and conventions, then we go to the official guidelines and then the AHA coding clinic. And there are ongoing concerns and issues with the removal of diagnoses that coding professionals are sharing with me. And yes, these diagnosis codes, yes, have a financial impact, a reimbursement impact. So there is an incentive there to deny that particular code on a claim. And I'm focusing mainly right now on inpatient hospitalizations and inpatient records. So we see, I've had reported to me that insurance payers are removing diagnosis codes. And the one focus I'm going to talk about is obesity and morbid obesity and the associated BMI. As you know, we have documentation in the medical record, electronic record, that reports this condition and the BMI. And we have a particular guidance around the reporting, coding, ICD-10 reporting of this. But what we're seeing from the payers is that they use the criteria that in the absence of that condition being evaluated, treated, monitored, or increasing the length of stay, that that cannot be reported. So we see, though, that there are some interesting concepts around this. And the first being, yes, we have the guidance around criteria for reporting of secondary diagnosis, additional diagnosis, that being clinical evaluation, therapeutic treatment, diagnostic procedures, extending the length of stay or nursing care and monitoring. We all know those and we look for those. We only need one for that documented diagnosis to be valid for reporting. We have under the UHDDS guidelines the definition of other diagnosis, all conditions that coexist at the time of the admission and develop subsequently and affect treatment and care and length of stay, similar to what we've had published before. And then we have the AHA coding clinic guidance or instruction that around obesity and morbid obesity, if you go back to the third quarter of 2011 and the pages 3 to 4, it states that individuals who are overweight, obese or morbidly obese are at an increased risk, for certain medical conditions when compared to persons in normal weight. Therefore, these conditions are always clinically significant and reportable when documented by the provider. Stop right there. Let's breathe. So they're always clinically significant. They need to be documented by the provider. So that's one criteria or element that we follow when we're coding. Then it continues to say, in addition, the body mass index meets the requirement for a clinical significant when obesity is documented. So when we have obesity or morbid obesity, the BMI should be reported. If you refer back even to some other criteria around coding clinic for the third quarter of 2007, it states some guidance that does not say and meets the criteria. So this particular snapshot of the coding clinic from third quarter 2011 and third quarter 2007 does not say that you have to meet the criteria above, but the payers are coming back and saying that, yes, you do need to meet that because, remember I read earlier, the hierarchy. We have our coding conventions and classification. We have our official guidelines and we have our coding clinic. So the criteria around this is kind of spinning out of control a little bit. And so how are we going to address this? Do hospitals appeal these situations or similar ones? Many times they are. Should the AHA coding clinic look at this guidance and revise their situation, their opinion, their guidance? Should the official guidelines be revised and clarified potentially? And I'm saying for all of those three, probably yes, yes, yes. And certainly this is impacting coding practices and also the capture of the patient's true medical story and history of the patient and their situation. So let's start by first communicating. We always got to do that, everybody. We got to communicate to the four cooperating parties who develop and approve, of course, what's published in Coding Clinic, but also the official guidelines. And I'd like to remind the ACT audience who the four cooperating parties are. We have the AHA, we have the AHIMA, we have CMS and the National Center for Health Statistics. And try first, maybe in addition, writing to AHA Coding Clinic as one of the four cooperating parties first. Share your example experience with this particular coding situation. You may have others that you'd like to share. And you can submit these questions online. I think we need to get a resolution. We need to get additional guidance out there. We need to get it quickly because the clock is ticking and every day there are impact to our coding, our ultimately reimbursement, and the adherence to these guidelines. And so that's all I have for now for you. Back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Gloria. I can give you from a clinician's perspective that clinically severe, which is what we call morbid obesity now, clinically severe obesity is always clinically significant. You know, they may have to have a different bed. It may take more than one nurse, you know,
to turn them.
You know, right. You know, there's definitely increased nursing care, you know, but the provider may not necessarily be documenting it, but the nursing staff probably is. And it's really unfair because it's definitely clinically significant. Thanks, Gloria-Ann. That was Gloria-Ann Bryant. She is an independent HIM consultant and past president of the California Health Information Association. Chuck, back to you.
Erica, thank you very much for your insight. And thank you again, Gloria-Ann Bryant, for substituting this morning for Lori Johnson.
Attention coding professionals and all HIM professionals. Now available on demand is the 3-day webcast series, which you need to hear to remain compliant with the 2024 Inpatient Prospective Payment System. It's the IPPS Coding Summit, produced by ICD-10 Monitor. During this exclusive summit, you'll learn about the important changes associated with the 2024 IPS, including new ICD-10 CM and PCS codes, plus insights, analysis, and answers to questions. Listen and learn with the on-demand IPS Coding Summit. On day one, you'll learn about changes to the ICD-10 CM codes. So be sure to listen to the IPS Coding Summit, especially day one, and learn about the important changes to the ICD-10 CM codes. That's the IPPS Coding Summit, produced by ICD-10 Monitor, and available now on demand at the ICD-10 Monitor Bookstore.
Thanks, Clark Anthony. And folks, by the way, day one is a very, very important webcast. It's all about the changes to the ICD-10 CM code. Very important. Here now with the Talk 10 Tuesday report on the social determinants of health is our good friend Tiffany Ferguson. And good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, all. So last week, I talked about the greater integration needed between CDI and UR. And with the nudge of Lori Johnson, who's missing this week, hopefully she's listening to the On Demand later, I thought I would discuss the benefits of coding and case management collaboration. So by no means is this going to be a discussion of how case management should be cross-trained to learn coding. However, I think there is value in coding being able to discuss with case management the role that case management documentation plays in the coding process. specifically how clear documentation on patient dispositions and SDOH risk factors will help with record integrity. As I have talked about in previous broadcasts, the need for a Z-code capture. What better way for coding to clarify and capture Z-codes than from the descriptive documentation CMs provide in their initial assessments and ongoing progress notes related to the involvement of patients' SDOH risk factors into the hospitalizations and its impact on the disposition plan? The next most important information for CM is for the post-acute transfer policy, the PACT policy by CMS, which applies to specific MS-DRGs rolled out in Table 5 of the annual releases for IPPS final ruling to potentially adjust if the patient is transferred to post-acute care settings or other dispositions like home health and hospice prior to the expected GMLOS for that DRG. At a high level, if a patient is discharged or transferred to one of the specific post-acute settings or transfer settings or services prior to the GMLOS, the payment is adjusted to a per diem rate that is calculated by dividing the MSDRG rate by the GMLOS for those less days. The OIG has historically reviewed the miscoding practices on several occasions, most recently in 2021, identifying overpayments by hospitals who inappropriately reported post-acute dispositions. Honestly, I see misses on both sides, over and under reporting. Sometimes it's just the mismatch, and here's why it's important. This is where CM documentation is so important because the final dispositions of the patient not only impacts the required specificity for the coding team, but also the reimbursement for the patient's hospitalization. So the post-acute locations listed, I include it, that is in that policy, is acute transfers to psychiatric hospitals, cancer hospitals, or children's hospitals, inpatient rehabs, long-term acute care hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, home with home health, care that begins within 3 days of discharge or is not resumptive of the services related to the hospitalization, and home with hospice at a facility or at home. So, for instance, if the patient is discharged home to their existing nursing home, the CM may put discharge to facility X. However, the coder will need to discern if that patient is just returning home to their long-term care facility or are they expected to also receive skilled nursing services at that facility. Another example is if the patient is discharged home with home health services. However, the CM documentation does not specify the start date of those services. The hospital will miss reimbursement opportunities if the patient's start date of services for home health is greater than 3 days post-hospital discharge. Additionally, if the home health services were a resumption of care and not related to the inpatient hospitalization, the hospital could be unnecessarily giving up some of their financial reimbursement. So CMs may not be aware of their value of their documentation, particularly for what it means for hospital reimbursement and record integrity. This is a great opportunity for coding to sit down with the new and existing CMs to review their existing documentation and discuss the needs for the coding side to make sure that CMs are accurately documenting the patient's social risk factors and that they are impacting the hospitalization and the post-acute plan. And with that, back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Tiffany. You know that I totally agree that we should make sure that UR and case management and CDIs all work together so that everybody knows how important documentation is to everybody. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is the CEO for Phoenix Medical Management.
Here's a special opportunity to learn about the comprehensive guidelines and best practices for secondary diagnosis coding during an illuminating ICD-10 monitor webcast. It takes you on a deep dive into the intricacies of accurately assigning secondary diagnosis codes to ensure precise medical documentation. You'll learn the essential insights, including documentation requirements, sequencing strategies, and industry updates. It's time to elevate your coding skills, and this special webcast is the place to learn how to stay current with the latest coding advancements. Learn how to determine the correct DRG assignment to optimize reimbursement, support medical decision-making, and maintain compliance. That webcast, Secondary Diagnosis Coding, a deep dive into guidelines and best practices, is September 20th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Register today.
As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, Angela Cuffert is with us today. And Angie's going to be reporting on what coders need to know at the intersection of artificial intelligence and coding. And good morning, Angie.
Good morning, Chuck. I am so pleased to be back with you guys again. Thank you for having me. So let's just jump right in. AI is such a huge topic, not just in tech language, but it's also becoming a really big area for healthcare. In the ever-evolving world of healthcare coding, the professionals must always stay abreast of the latest updates to the ICD-10-CM and, of course, PCS and CPT, because the dynamic coding system is vital for recording diagnosis and conditions and other health-related information, just like the social determinants of health we just heard about. With the rise of artificial intelligence technologies in healthcare, the ICD-10-CM coding landscape is undergoing very significant changes. AI is impacting various healthcare facets, from diagnostics to personalized treatment plans. But particularly in coding, AI holds great promise to transform how our coding professionals actually interpret the clinical documentation and assign the codes. We all know that machine learning is a subset of AI, and it can sift through vast data sets to detect patterns and support coding decisions. That automation kind of leads to improvements in accuracy, reduced manual effort from the coders themselves, and the capacity to manage large data volumes. However, that potential is not without its challenges. AI tools, despite their advanced opportunities and capabilities, can occasionally misinterpret ambiguous documentation, or they also can lack the nuance necessary for complex decision-making. I mentioned this earlier to Chuck and the team. AI cannot take over the thinking for coders. So our coders must continue to exercise their expertise, their judgment, when they are reviewing those AI-assisted code assignments. The vigilance is crucial for this to ensure that our AI-assisted coding assignments meet stringent standards of quality as well as coding compliance. Also, our coding professionals' roles are evolving in this area of AI. For years and years and years, we've heard, natural language processing and artificial intelligence and all this computer-assisted coding is going to get rid of coders. Definitely not getting rid of coders. We have to have our coders to translate and ensure that the AI and the NLP are actually doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. And sometimes there are issues that while AI tools are powerful allies, our coders actually remain those experts. Their invaluable knowledge of the coding guidelines, medical terminology, and clinical practices is irreplaceable, even by a computer. The coders should be ready to leverage those AI technologies while safeguarding the quality and compliance of their coding assignments. We need to make sure that we have continuous training and education in the ever-changing landscape of AI. As our coding guidelines evolve and our AI technologies advance, our coders have to stay informed. Keeping pace with these developments will empower our coders to harness AI's benefits while mitigating its risks. The ongoing learning will enable our coding professionals to sharpen those skills and stay updated on the latest AI innovations and the revisions to the code sets. The potential for artificial intelligence to enhance coding education and training should not be overlooked. We have AI-driven tools that can offer adaptive learning experiences tailored specifically to a certain coder's unique needs. And that's something that we would have to do manually in the past. So, I mean, there are great things about artificial intelligence. We can have AI create coding simulations that presents complex scenarios and test our coders' skills and provide real-time feedback, where, again, we, as the managers of coders, had to do all of this manually, find those really complex cases to ensure that our coders that we had on staff knew
about our patient population, our demographic, and what diagnosis and procedures they were being treated. And then we would have to give real-time feedback in conversations, telling our coders what they got right, what they may have missed or overlooked. So coders and coding managers should actively explore the AI-driven training to bolster their coding proficiencies. Then we have to look at the ethical considerations, because those are paramount as AI technologies become more ingrained in the coding process. We have algorithms that may inadvertently perpetuate biases that present in the training data, potentially impacting accuracy and the fairness of coding assignments through AI. We believe that coders should engage in discussions about the ethical implications of AI in coding. You know, work with your compliance department. Make sure that they understand what you're being, what you're doing when you're utilizing a coding vendor that's utilizing AI, which there are a few out there that is truly moving down that path of artificial intelligence and pairing that up with natural language processing. They need to make sure that they are advocating for transparency in the AI development process and policies that actually prioritize fairness, accuracy, and human oversight. Then we have our collaboration between our coding professionals, coding managers, and our AI developers. And that is crucial for AI technologies to be able to reach their full potential in the coding industry. The coder's deep knowledge of those coding guidelines, the clinical practice, healthcare documentation is invaluable. And by sharing the insights with the AI developers, coders can influence the development of the AI tools that may be able to address unique challenges of the coding profession. Coders should actively collaborate with AI developers and provide feedback on those AI-driven coding tools. While AI has the potential to revolutionize ICD-10 CM coding, it is definitely not a substitute for human expertise. By staying current with evolving coding guidelines, engaging in the AI-driven training, addressing ethical considerations, and collaborating with AI developers, coding professionals can effectively harness AI's power. In this AI era, coders' expertise and judgment remain indispensable, ensuring highest standards of coding quality and compliance are met. Let's toss it back over to Erica.
Thanks, Angie. That was a great assessment of AI and coding. That was Angela Comfort. She is a senior consultant for E4 Services and CDI Transformational Leader at Montefiore Health System. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, and thank you again, Angie. And be sure to read her report in today's ICD-10 Monitor. Here now with a very popular segment on Talk to Tuesdays called Talk Back, and it features our very own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it's all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. A 2023 update to AHIMA's clinical validation practice has been released. The previous version from 2019 said, quote, "When a query professional writes a clinical validation query, they are not performing clinical validation. Rather, they are highlighting a potential gap between a documented diagnosis and the clinical evidence in the health record. The diagnostic decision remains the responsibility of the treating provider," close quote. I agree with the premise that only a clinician taking care of the patient can truly perform clinical validation. You can ask, doctor, is that condition really present or not? But only they can make that judgment. But we refer to the process of trying to reconcile documented diagnoses with clinical indicators present as clinical validation. I'm okay with that, as long as the CDIS or coder recognizes that the provider often has more in their head than they put down in the record, and a determination as to clinical validity can't really be made without querying. There is a section where I think the authors got a little mixed up. The practice brief asserts that the, quote, "reporting of a diagnosis can lead to denials if there is inadequate documentation to demonstrate that the patient is receiving more than routine care," close quote. I think they should have been more explicit about what routine care is referring to. They use acute blood loss anemia, ABLA, as an example and state that, quote, This diagnosis may be considered routine slash expected when documented in the health record for surgical patients having a procedure that routinely requires treatment with blood products during surgery, such as hip replacement and coronary artery bypass, close quote. That doesn't nullify the diagnosis of acute blood loss anemia in conjunction with a hip fracture or coronary artery disease. Those procedures may routinely involve blood replacement because ABLA often occurs as a result of the pathology and/or the procedure. That doesn't invalidate the diagnosis, it supports it. I think what they were trying to convey is that when a decrease in hemoglobin results after a condition which might be expected to have that outcome, the clinician needs to demonstrate that they believe the drop is clinically significant by taking some action and documenting it appropriately in order for it to be a codable diagnosis. Clinically significant means the provider thinks the condition is meaningful in terms of having to work it up, treat it, or it makes the course more complicated than average, like more nursing care or an increased length of stay, like Glorian was talking about. Clinically valid means the condition is present. If a patient is in the hospital for atrial fibrillation and exacerbation of heart failure, and they incidentally have bilateral cataracts, the ophthalmological condition is clinically valid, but not likely to be clinically significant and reportable. Clinical validation is done when it isn't clear whether a diagnosis is present according to the available clinical indicators. The coder is not permitted to just discount a documented diagnosis, even if the clinical indicators are insufficient to support it. Clinical validation queries are the best tool we have to determine whether a condition exists. It is optimal to settle that prior to billing as opposed to incurring a clinical validation denial months or years later. By then, no additional clinical support can be entered into the record. Conversely, if a coder or CDIS has a concern that a condition is not adequately supported by the clinical indicators, coding it just because the doctor or provider documented it could lead to compliance issues. To take it to the extreme, if a provider were to express that they know the condition isn't really present, but they were told to document it anyway because it meant more money, the coder would have an ethical obligation to not code it. The practice brief recommends having an escalation policy to avoid this unsavory scenario. For more information, read my article in the practice brief. The documentation best practices and query examples are quite helpful. As an aside, I am seeking input from nurse CDISs who had to, during or after COVID, work clinical shifts. If this applies to you, please email me. I put my email in the comments. And with that, Chuck, back to you.
Thanks, Erica, very much. That was an excellent topic, and we appreciate it very much. And folks, that's going to be a wrap for this live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. I want to thank our panelists today. Tiffany Ferguson, Gloria Ann Bryan, who substituted for Lori Johnson, Tim Powell of the News Desk, Angela Cuffer, who returned and reported our lead story this morning. And of course, a very special thank you to my co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. And folks, a program note, there won't be a Talk 10 Tuesday next Tuesday. We're going to be observing Labor Day, but we will be back to this very spot on September the 12th. We look forward to your being with us at that time. Until then, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Talk 10 Tuesday. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend and a compliant Labor Day. Goodbye, folks.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.